We got exciting news this week that WWE and Netflix agreed on a $5 billion deal for the streaming giant to broadcast Monday Night Raw, WWE's flagship live event show. As part of that deal, there was a follow-up announcement that I thought was particularly interesting, that Dwayne Johnson was going to be joining the board of directors for TKO, the newly formed WWE UFC entity. If you don't know wrestling, wrestlers, it was very common in the day to go by different names so that the business controlled ownership of the character's name. Now for The Rock, one of the most famous wrestlers of all time, that was obviously a massive deal. And so I wanted to get more information and understand more about what that actually meant, not only for Johnson, but for businesses overall. So I invited my good friend Kevin Hartley, co-founder and CEO of Trust Tree Trademark, on to have a conversation about what trademarks are, how businesses should be thinking about them, and what their impact on branding is. And so without further ado, the first episode, Crow Knows, to find out if Crow knows trademarks. Feel alive, let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, my break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, y'all got the semi-fold weight. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and tried to locate. This for the time, got time for no day. War. Welcome everybody to the Crow Knows podcast. I'm joined by my good friend Kevin Hartley, co-founder and CEO of Trust Tree Legal. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
As a fellow wrestling fan, I know you're a perfect person to have on to talk about this particular topic and a little interesting slant on it. Obviously, we know that WWE and Netflix announced a huge partnership, a $5 billion deal for Netflix to jump into the live rights world with being able to broadcast not only WWE Raw, but pay-per-views, live content, scripted shows, things like that. But the more interesting nugget to me was embedded in a follow-up announcement from TKO, the newly formed entity between WWE and UFC, where they announced that Dwayne Johnson was going to be joining the board of directors, and part of his compensation package was going to be granting Dwayne Johnson the full trademark rights to the name The Rock. We'll get into that more in a minute, but I wanted first to give you a chance to talk to us, tell the listeners about what your background is, not only in the legal world, but the trademark world, and why you are the perfect person to have on here.
Well, you know, like you, AJ, I grew up a huge fan of wrestling, and for wrestling fans, trademark disputes should be a little bit familiar, especially if you're around our age, because we all remember when WWE was WWF, and the result of that rebrand had to do with the World Wildlife Foundation and a dispute with formerly WWF. So, you know, an industry where both the companies involved and the personalities involved certainly are no strangers to trademarks. My background is that second grade career day, I went as a lawyer, and I was sort of preordained, it felt, to become a lawyer, and that's exactly what I did. And I grew up playing sports, very competitive, as you know and I know, we've played sports together, and thought that litigating would really be the thing I wanted to do. But then I started practicing law and discovered that, you know, when you litigate, you often are tearing businesses down. And truthfully, I wanted to help build businesses up. And over time, that led me to trademarks. And so for a decade now, I've exclusively practiced trademark law. I have a trademark firm that I started with a few friends. Our focus is low-cost, high-quality trademark services.
So what I know about trademarks is they give you protection and the ability to sue people. That's it. What am I missing?
You're missing really what I think the most important thing about trademarks is, which is their value to their owners. When I talk to clients about trademarks, sure. Can they help you in court if you need to enforce your rights? Yes. You can use them, as we say, a sword and a shield. You know, if you have a trademark registration, you can use that to go after an infringer. Also, if somebody comes after you claiming infringement, a registration can help you defend yourself against that. But really, when I talk to clients, the more important thing to me is about protecting the business and the brand. And really, it's about protecting the goodwill of the brand. It's really a way to make the intangible goodwill of a brand tangible. For that reason, I just think trademarks are one of the best value propositions for any business. And I'm happy to explain a little bit more. You know, 40,000 foot view, and I think this is important though, is explain what a trademark is. People interchangeably use the words trademark, copyright, and patent just colloquially. And before I was an attorney, and even when I was in law school, I probably still did the same. It wasn't until I took an intellectual property class I really understood the difference. But 40,000 foot view, it's very simple. Patents protect inventions, copyrights protect works of art, and trademarks protect source identifiers. Anything that a consumer uses to identify a source of goods or services is a trademark. So typically, it's going to be a brand name or a logo or a slogan, but it can even be a sound. If I make this sound, da da da, da da da, what do you think of?
ESPN.
Absolutely. That's a trademark. The NBC chimes, the same thing. It can be a color. I got my wife our first dating anniversary. Only time I've done this, I got her jewelry from Tiffany. And before she even opened the box, she looked at me and said, I know what this is because the color they use is a trademark. So anything a consumer uses to identify a source of goods or services, that's a trademark. And because of that, they're incredibly valuable because it really is how people recognize your brand.
I thought for a second you were going to say that you got your wife a trademark, something for your wife for her anniversary. That would have been super romantic. So you mentioned a couple of things in there that are key. One, you mentioned goodwill on a business, and that's something a lot of people look at, talk about. They may see it in a way that companies are valued, things like that. Largely seems like a crock of BS to most people. And that's where I think a lot of people, whether there be fraud things come up or people really start to question that. And I don't think a lot of people realize that that intellectual property is wrapped up in there. So can you tell us, in your experience, when it comes to valuing a trademark, how does that generally work? How would a company of business owners or key decision makers that are in this process thinking about that, how should they be thinking about how that will impact the value of their business moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is right at the heart of what I was talking about. So, when you go to value a business, say you go to sell a business, you go to invest in a business, and you're doing your due diligence, whichever side of the transaction you're on, you're generally going to value the goodwill of the business. There's going to be a line item that says goodwill. And when you have registered trademarks, studies show that that number goes up. The more registered trademarks you have, in fact, a recent study shows the higher that number goes. Your valuation goes up when you have trademark registrations, but there's good reason underlying that. It's not just because you have registrations and that means all of a sudden that the goodwill is more valuable. Again, I talked about making something intangible tangible. It's, turning that goodwill into a more concrete asset, but it does make sense. And I'm going to give you an example. Take Google. Google's trademark portfolio has been valued back in 2011 by Forbes at somewhere around $44 billion. And since then, I've seen valuations all over the place into the hundreds of billions of dollars. But it makes sense because if tomorrow I decided I'm going to launch my own search engine and I go to Google and I say, I want to pay you for your algorithm. For lack of a better way of putting it, right? I just want to have your search algorithm. I want your user interface. I want to pay you for all these tangible things that consumers engage with when they come to run a search at your website. But I do all those things and then I name it TrustTree. Who's coming to TrustTree.com tomorrow to run a search? Even if the search result they get will be the same quality as one they would get if they went to Google. Who's coming? Probably nobody. The cost of acquisition of those people is going to be incredibly high. I'm going to have to pay for a Super Bowl ad to get anybody to consider coming to my new search engine, even if it is superior or on equal footing with Google. But if tomorrow I were to buy Google's trademark portfolio and their top-level domain name, you know what happens? Everybody still is coming to my search engine to run their searches. Now, the question is, can I develop behind that, right, well enough to ensure that I don't lose consumers as they discover that maybe the results aren't what they expect. But the point still remains, that's what consumers rely on. That's everything. The name, the trademarks, you build your brand for a reason, and you build it so that consumers trust it and recognize it, and that's where the value is. Sometimes I say it this way: your brand is like your personality, your trademark is like your signature. If you compare it to a person, or if we want to make it like a sports analogy, it's almost like your jersey. You know, if I see somebody on a street in a Kansas City jersey with the number 15 on it, I know that that's Patrick Mahomes, whether I see Mahomes or not, right? And it's the same sort of thing. It's like there's something you recognize. And with the best brands, there's a feeling they give you. That's really what branding is. Branding is about how do I want consumers to feel when they engage with my business? And then people build around that. And so the trademarks are the best way, again, to make that tangible. And also to ensure that, you know, you hopefully are not buying something that is going to get you involved in a lawsuit without any recourse. You know, if you buy a company and they say they own the trademark, but they don't have the registration, there's a vulnerability there that you certainly want to avoid.
Yeah. So everything that you just said, I think everybody that's listening to this would agree with, and it makes complete sense. So why, in your experience, what are the pushback that you get from either talking with business owners or people involved in decision-making that have opportunities to be on top of their trademark game and file and do all this stuff properly? What are the main reasons that you hear from people that are reluctant to do this or people that haven't done it? Why are they saying that they haven't done it?
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion about when you actually have a trademark or when you've registered a trademark. A lot of people think when they go and set up an LLC that that means they own the trademark, for example, because maybe they had to put the name in somewhere with their Secretary of State. Or, for example, with your Secretary of State, you can register a business name. So I talk to people all the time who will actually say, oh, well, we already have our trademark. And, you know, so part of it's that lack of education into what the process really is, which truthfully is a year to 2 year generally process at this point through the federal government. You would know if you registered a trademark. It's not the sort of thing that you just show up, at least federally, and fill out one form and then it's done. You know, it's going to take filing something and there are going to be updates and you will eventually receive a notice that your mark has registered. But until or unless that happens, you haven't registered. So number one, I think there's just some confusion about it. And then number two, you know, when you start a business, especially because I work with a lot of startups and small businesses, it's death by a thousand cuts. Everything you have to do has a cost. And a lot of people see investing in a trademark as sort of a low priority thing to do, or at least a trademark registration. I, on the other hand, of course, encourage people to consider it part of their marketing budget, if nothing else. You know, we charge a flat fee of $975 to prepare and file a trademark application. That includes the government filing fee. It includes a search report. What else in this world can you spend $1,000 on that may in the future be worth millions or billions of dollars? I'm not saying everybody's going to be Google, but you don't have to be Google. You know, we had a client who had registered a Meta trademark. And, you know, I don't know all the details of how the deal went down, but that trademark was later acquired by Facebook. And I think they did pretty well on that deal. You know,
just to make sure everyone heard that right. You had a client that registered the trademark of Meta before mm-hmm. Facebook became Meta.
Years ago. And then they were reached out to by Facebook. So I say you just never know. I mean, it's certainly a $975 investment, you know, when you work with us. There can be a few other small fees along the way, and there's some renewal fees that come into play down the road. But, you know, again, it's just one of those things to me that's such a no-brainer. I mean, I truly believe in it. That's why I do this work. I really got, you know, disillusioned with legal practice. And trademarks were the things that kept me in it because I feel good about what I do day to day. I love helping people register their trademarks for the exact reasons we're talking about. You know, they bring a lot of value. But another reason why I think people don't register their trademarks is that it can be somewhat confusing understanding sort of the bounds of your trademark protection. What exactly does my trademark protect? There's this common misconception that when you register a trademark, that means you have the exclusive right to use it for all things. And that's not the case. And most people actually would realize that if they really just sat and thought about it, right? For example, Delta Airlines and Delta Faucet. Those are two entirely different companies. They're both allowed to register and have registered the trademark Delta because their services or goods are so distinct that we don't think a consumer would confuse one for the other. Same thing with Dove, Dove soap, Dove chocolate. You know, those are two very different things, often sold in the same store. But again, consumers are less likely to confuse them. So Number one, your trademark rights inevitably are always tied to the goods or services you provide or those a consumer would think a business like yours would provide. But then there's a second element, which is that you have a trademark from the day you start using anything as a source identifier in commerce in the United States. So once you open your business and you launch, for example, this podcast, Crow Knows, the day you put a podcast up, whether you had applied to register the trademark or not, you have common law trademark rights. This is a trademark. You do have rights, rights that could still be enforced in court, perhaps. The thing about those rights is the extent of them is a little bit hard to determine, because when you have common law trademark rights, they are limited to the geographic area in which you use the trademark. And that's the sort of thing you don't really want to leave up to a court to decide. Because, for example, here I am in Nashville, and we use TrustTree, which we have registered. But had we not done that, and had we gotten involved in a lawsuit, it could be that somebody, a court may have found that our trademark rights extended to the city of Nashville, or Davidson County, where it's located, or Middle Tennessee, or the state of Tennessee, or the Southeast, or east of the Mississippi, or the whole country. But when you register your trademark federally, you get a presumption of validity and enforceability nationwide. So a lot of people don't register, I think, because number one, they think they have. Or number two, they've been told, well, you don't have to because you have rights. And it's true that they do. But again, getting back to this idea of why I think a registration especially is so important. Because when it comes time to sell your business or bring on investors into your business, and I think as most business owners, they want that. They want at least an exit strategy. And so having that registration is what actually gives people peace of mind that you do own the thing you say you own. It's like having the deed to your house. You know, you need that thing to show you do own what you say you own and give people confidence in that.
Yeah. So you just said something that I think is probably going to, not probably, but could confuse people by mentioning common law rights, right? You've got a common law trademark. And so in reality, if we say, hey, I've got a common law, you know, rights to the trademark of Crow Knows for this podcast, but then somebody else that sees all the wild success I'm having and how absolutely incredible that this show is says, hey, I want to jump on this bandwagon. And so I'm going to go file a trademark for Crow Knows to be able to either force my hand to then come bring that under their umbrella, or they can then set up a brand where they think that they're going to be able to duplicate what I've got going here, which we know they can't, but it still stands. So how does that work in reality, where I would then go and say, hey, they're using my branding. They'll say, did you file a trademark? They'll look on the trademark. The other person has it, but we've got recorded evidence here that I started this before they filed for that trademark. So how does that wind up working?
Tell you, your listeners, they're going to get really, this is like deep dive trademark 101 stuff. The United States, in my opinion, has the most fair trademark laws in the world, but ours are complicated. We have what's called a modified first to use system for determining who has the priority rights to a trademark. So what does that mean? As a general rule in the United States, the first party to use a trademark in commerce has the priority rights to that mark, not the first party to file a trademark application. There's one exception to that, which is where a party files what's called an intent to use trademark application. So that's where you say, okay, I know I'm going to launch this business, and maybe we'll get into this later, because this is often my recommendation to businesses, is to file as soon as you've settled on that name so you get the registration process going, number one. But number two, the reason you want to do that is because when you file a trademark application in the United States before you start using the trademark in commerce, what happens is that becomes your constructive first use date. So say I filed a trademark application today. It's January 26, 2024 for a trademark I have not used yet. Okay. We'll call it TrustTree, and I'm going to file it for podcasting services. All right. If I file that application today, okay, but I don't launch my TrustTree podcast until July 4th, 2024. Okay. In the interim, if somebody else were to start a TrustTree podcast, but not file anything, even though they would have used that trademark before me, I don't use it until July 1st, say they launch March 1st, because I filed today, January 26th, so long as I do start using the trademark in commerce, I get to jump back to that filing date. This is what we do to ensure that people, as they're building businesses, feel comfortable going ahead and filing and revealing their name even before they've launched, so they don't get taken advantage of, where somebody else gets to say, well, actually, I used it first, even though you filed first, right? Now, the scenario you threw out was different, but I just want to be clear on how our system works, which is complicated, but very fair, again, because it's either the first to use or the first to file if nobody has yet used. Is kind of the way to think about it. But in the scenario you threw out, this is an important example of why I really think it's worth it to file and file as soon as you can. Because, okay, you launch Crow Knows podcast, people love it. Somebody realizes, this guy hasn't applied to register this as a trademark. I'm going to launch my own Crow Knows podcast. I'm going to file a trademark application, right? And they do that. Well, as I just said, you as the first user do have the priority rights, but it's not so simple as just saying, I'm the first user, I have priority. I wish it was. You may start by sending them a cease and desist letter, to which there's a good chance they're going to try to then bargain with you, because they're going to say, well, I've got this registration or I've got this pending application already. Why don't we agree that I can use it, but I'll also allow you to register? Or why don't you pay me to go away, right? That sort of thing. You may not want to do any of that. But then what happens? Well, you do have an opportunity to oppose that application during the trademark registration process. Oppositions typically take one or more years. They typically cost tens of thousands, if not potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So all of a sudden, that either unwillingness or unawareness that it would be worthwhile to file that trademark application that would have cost you $975, for example, at the beginning, now is going to cost you, at a minimum, thousands of dollars to have a lawyer go and at least, you know, draft that cease and desist letter, draft a settlement agreement, or file a notice of opposition, any of these many things you may have to do to kind of claw back your rights that you otherwise might not have to deal with, right? Yeah. I mean, this is... picture cliche, blocking and tackling, right? That's what registering your trademark is something you do to maximize your opportunity to protect your business. Doesn't mean that you're guaranteed to never have to file a lawsuit against somebody for infringement. Does it guarantee that nobody's ever going to show up and claim, actually, I owned that first? It doesn't guarantee you any of those things. All of those things could happen. What you're trying to do is maximize your odds of success in the event you get into a dispute over the trademark.
It sounds a little bit like, and I'm interested to see if this is part of or as prevalent in a trademark. I think a lot of people have heard of patent trolls, where you've got this cottage industry that's developed where people just file these very broad-based patents, go to companies, podcasts, you know, anybody that's got some sort of activity that they can reasonably sue for, or, you know, send a cease and desist or something for that, with ultimately the goal being just to grab settlement money. Is that something that goes on in the trademark world very often, or is that something that's a little more, because of the nature of patents versus trademarks, just a little more conducive to be in the patent world?
Well, what led me to trademarks was the patent world. I was a patent litigator early in my career. And I got a little bit disillusioned because what I noticed is pretty much every case we had ended because one party had to file bankruptcy because of how expensive the litigation was. But I digress a little bit. You know, the patent trolls is probably worth an entire other podcast because a lot's been done to root them out. And truthfully, that was in many ways more of a flash in the pan, because what happened is all these parties were able to register these very broad trademarks, often covering services that would be provided online way back when. So to register a patent, you must have an invention that's non-obvious and novel. And so if you can imagine an early time of the internet, or when the internet is just dawning, people show up and they file, you know, a patent application that's like a system for ordering products online. And I dealt with a patent that, you know, I mean, I'm being very like, there was a lot more to it, but the simple way of putting what the patent was, that was the patent. And they had sued basically every Fortune 500 company. And we were representing a few of them in this matter where, you know, at the time, this patent was granted because nobody could foresee the idea that somebody would be ordering things online. And then, of course, that's where everything went. And it's like, well, this patent never would have been granted had people had more knowledge that they probably should have had. But what it did was it allowed this opportunity for, you know, venture capital or other businesses to say, oh, well, we'll go in and we'll buy this patent from somebody and we'll just, you know, build this system where we'll sue everybody and see if we can get, you know, sue everybody in the Fortune 500 and ask everybody for $20,000.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the cost of this litigation is going to be $1 million.
Right.
So why not just pay us $20,000? So you don't really see the same thing that you see with patent trolls in the trademark industry, but you certainly see people try to take advantage of maybe an owner forgets to renew their trademark. Well, once that happens, or their trademark registration, I should say, and it gets canceled. I've dealt with this before on behalf of my clients. Other parties will sometimes go in and file an application and try to register that mark. And then it's the same thing I'm talking about. Our clients got to spend money one way or another, whether it's on us or paying that party something to resolve the issue that they otherwise could have avoided.
Yeah, it sounds like something that I feel like I hear a lot more in the, you hear it a lot in the pharmaceutical world, right? Or you know, in food and things like that, where there's, you know, a recipe or something is locked up, the copyright or patent usually on it is locked up. And then once that's done, then it becomes, you know, people can launch generic versions and things like that, which makes sense. So this has all been incredible. And now I want to get a little bit back out of the weeds and bring it back to what we started talking about, which spurred this conversation, which was The Rock. And for those that aren't as familiar with the wrestling world, like, this is super common where wrestlers will wrestle for a promotion or a company under a different name. That's obviously not their own name. A lot of reasons for that. Usually in WWE world, especially for Vince McMahon, he wanted to control those trademarks. And so what does it mean for people that don't understand necessarily what's going on here? The Rock getting the full rights to the trademark, Dwayne Johnson getting the rights to the Rock trademark. Talk to the listeners a little bit about what that means. And you can put it in wrestling terms because you've got a tremendous understanding of that. So talk to us a little bit about why that would be a part of this agreement and what that means for Dwayne Johnson.
Well, you know, we've been sitting here talking about the value of trademarks. I use Google as an example. I mean, I can't think of a celebrity who has a trademark that would be more valuable than The Rock's. That is an incredibly valuable trademark. And, you know, if I'm The Rock, I don't want to be sharing money every time I have to use that trademark. But that was the case. You know, just getting back briefly to what you were talking about with the wrestling promotions, and really, you know, WWE has been a huge part of this, and sort of was the company that really established the sort of business practice, if you will, common to that industry, which is they would go and register the name and trademark on behalf of the company that any wrestler might use, and it would be tied to the merchandise. Just getting back briefly to something I mentioned earlier but didn't really go into, you know, your trademark rights are tied to the goods or services you provide under the trademark. So, for example, there's not just a trademark out there that says The Rock. You have to identify products or services. So if you were to look up The Rock trademark, you'd probably find all sorts of merchandise, right? Clothing, action figures, the sorts of things WWE sells using the name The Rock in order to get consumers to buy those products, right? So, you know, the business practice was about additional streams of revenue, really, for these wrestling promotions and control, because what you don't want is to create a star, and this was a big reason early on, and then they leave, and now all of a sudden your competitor is able to sell all of the Rock merchandise and get a cut out of that when you are the company that helped truly build that, right? You know, Dwayne Johnson, I think, is incredibly talented, but the WWE has a fair argument that he never becomes what he became, if not for them. So, right. You know, there's always been this tension, though, because so many wrestlers are so tied to their personas. And many wrestlers have, you know, had battles with WWE over this. And, you know, you and I both have seen some of the names people have used when they've gone to other promotions to try to, like, touch on, but not exactly, you know, infringe upon their old rights. I mean, the Ultimate Warrior, my favorite wrestler when I was a very young child, had a giant falling out with the WWE over this entire issue. You know, he legally changed his name to Warrior that he could use it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so, but I want to get back to the value proposition here and why this is so important to The Rock.
Yeah.
I mean, Dwayne Johnson right now, still, despite maybe a few recent misfires, is, you know, the most bankable box office star in the world. And for years and years and years, anytime he wanted to use The Rock related to any of the things he was doing, where he was getting paid something, you know, he was having to share a percentage of that, my understanding is, with WWE still, right? So getting this, I mean, you know, it's not just that he's going to now not have to share that money, but now there are probably things he maybe wouldn't consider doing before that he would consider doing now, because the name no longer has that same tie to WWE, and he doesn't have to worry about anybody else maybe having a say in what sort of products, right? For example, WWE might be in bed with Chevy, and Ford comes to The Rock, is like, hey, we want to put you in a Ford commercial. And the WWE may have had the ability to put the kibosh on that and say, no, you can be in it, but you can't use The Rock. We have an exclusive deal with Chevy, you know? So it, you know, if you really just start thinking about all the ways in which him not having this full ownership might impact his ability to monetize the name, you know, there are a lot. So I think there are people who could look at something like this and say, oh, well, you know, if they were already giving him a percentage, which is my understanding that there was a share percentage beforehand, you know, did he really need this? But I think it's not just the money in this case, but it's the control and the ability to go do with it what you want.
The money's going to matter, because when the XFL and USFL merger inevitably goes south and that company goes into bankrupt, he's going to need to have something to offset that. I love his passion, and I think he really just did that so that he could get out there in the jersey and go in shorts. And
well, look, I think we both think that this Roman Reigns match is coming, and I have a feeling that more Rock merch is going to be sold in the next few months than has probably been sold in the past couple years, at least wrestling merch.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would say that, you know, the timing's not surprising. If he's going to come back to wrestle another match, I have a feeling that, you know, that also was a little bit behind this, because he wants to capitalize as best he can if he's going to be putting his body on the line like that again.
And if he's got a potential presidential run in him at some point in the next decade or so, it's going to be a lot easier when he's got full control over that as well. And you mentioned at the beginning, probably the one of the most important public trademark battles over a brand that had to, I mean, it's probably one of the only times in the last, correct me if I'm wrong, but the last 30, 40 years where a company that was as well known as a World Wrestling Federation at that time was, that actually lost a trademark battle with the World Wildlife Foundation to have to rebrand. Go back and put us in the time machine a little bit from your understanding of how that went down. Obviously, we were much younger at that time, but has there ever been any other situation similar to that in modern times?
You know, I wrote a blog post about this probably 10, 11 years ago now, that I don't remember all that well, but as a wrestling fan, I was constantly looking for things, you know, to blog about related to trademarks. And, you know, I used my passions a lot. So I would write about football, musicals, wrestling. But, you know, the thing that stood out to me, and you just really hit upon it, it's so rare that you see a really well-known company have to rebrand under those circumstances. And so the thing is, there's a lot of decisions that were probably made related to that we aren't aware of. This is my prediction. This is just me reading the tea leaves. This is not getting back into the, like, you know, the weeds of the dispute. I think that the, you know, people who were the decision makers at WWE at the time probably in some ways at some point said, you know what? Are we better off as World Wrestling Entertainment than the World Wrestling Federation? Because, as you know, as wrestling changed, you know, when we were kids, kayfabe was still like how wrestlers lived.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were stories of wrestlers getting
kayfabe, for those of you that aren't wrestling fans, is basically it was the common practice where everything was protected. There was no blending of reality and storyline.
It was real.
Yeah.
It was real. You know, the wrestlers would get in fights at bars with people who would say to them, wrestling's fake.
Yep.
So that's where we grew up initially. But then the tide started to turn and wrestling started to embrace this sort of like blend of what's real and what isn't, and started to steer into the idea of sports entertainment. And that's how they always refer to things. They would call The Rock the biggest star in sports entertainment.
Yep.
Right. So I do think that that played into it for the reason you mentioned. It's really rare you see an established company have to rebrand. And there's actually there are reasons for that. There are a few defenses to trademark infringement claims that are common for a business that's been in business for a long time, that are based on principles of equity, principles of fairness. It's really one of the few times you can argue in a case that you shouldn't have to do something because it's simply not fair. And I'm going to give you an example. Okay. So you start the Kronos podcast today. Okay. And you use it for the next 10 years and it becomes pretty popular. And then out of nowhere, you get, you know, a cease and desist letter from somebody in Ketchikan, Alaska, who runs a small AM radio station and who has a crow nose radio program. And they say, hey, we see you're using crow nose for this audio program that you're disseminating nationwide. We have the priority rights. We've been using this trademark for 20 years. And you look up and you're like, but wait a second, I've been using it for 10. Right? Well, that's one of those things that our courts generally will say, it wouldn't be fair. It would be inequitable to make you, AJ, now change your name, Kronos. Why? Because you've spent 10 years growing the brand, growing a fan base, right? Building this business. Whereas if that party reaches out to you next week and sends you that letter, you might be expected to stop. And of course, more likely to enforce that, right? Because you haven't invested or they haven't waited to see if you're going to be successful. I mean, I see this routinely. It feels like people are waiting because they're like, oh, well, you know, that person's using our trademark, but it's not interfering with our business yet. And I always warn them. I say, look, you can't sit on your rights, though, because generally, if you sit on your rights and you don't take action, you can lose your rights or they can certainly become weaker. So the thing I just point to with WWE and WWF is I think there must have been other good reasons why the WWE ultimately decided to resolve that dispute.
Yeah.
I think that, as I recall, they had maybe had a few rulings that had gone against them in some capacity, but I think it's the sort of fight they could have continued to fight had they not determined that maybe this rebrand in this way is actually worthwhile to us.
They probably also had the idea already for the Get the F Out branding campaign that was one of the greatest of all time.
When I talk to clients about this stuff all the time, you know, we have clients who have to rebrand and they're often very frustrated about it at first, but I tell them this is an opportunity. You know, you can treat it as an opportunity. You know so much more about your business now. I bet if you knew as much about your business when you started as you know now, you may have considered other names. You know, my partners and I came up with a name, you know, I don't know, maybe a year after we started operating, we were like, you know, that would have been a great name too. We do love our name, but those sorts of things happen. So, you know, you can certainly treat it as an opportunity. And that's another little tip though I would give to any business facing a rebrand. You know, we do have clients who sometimes I think are scared to register trademarks, going back to something you talked about before, because they know there are other people out there who, the more recognizable they became, may actually have a gripe with the trademark they chose, right? And that's not a position you want to be in. You want to be able to pursue unfettered growth, and you don't want to be concerned that the trademark you chose is going to hold you back. If you think it is, you should take steps to either rebrand or perhaps reach out to the parties that you think might stand in your way and cut a deal.
Yeah. This has all been incredible. I mean, it's a topic that I think a lot of people think they may know a little bit about, but just there's so many details and nuances in it. And so this has been a really, really awesome conversation to have. Before I let you get out, one of our recurring segments that we're going to have here is what I want to call Mount Rushmore, where I ask my guests to give me their Mount Rushmore of a particular topic. And so for this one, there's maybe no easier and more fun conversation to have than who is your Mount Rushmore of wrestlers of all time.
Okay, I'm just going to preface this. I know I said this earlier. Ultimate Warrior was my favorite wrestler as a child, but he would not make my Mount Rushmore, not under any circumstance. You know, when you're young, you don't understand that, like, you need the mic skill. You need a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
The truth about me is I'm just the sort of person who is likely to cheer against whomever is the top dog in anything. So, you know, growing up as a kid, I hated the Yankees. I hated the Cowboys. I hated Hulk Hogan. Mm. History's maybe proved me right on that one. In any event, so I was a big Ultimate Warrior fan, and I loved Macho Man. Like, those were my guys as, like, a little kid. But my Mount Rushmore does not include either of them. And because I was such a WWF / WWE guy, the hardest cut for me is probably Ric Flair, who I have so much, like, love and admiration for, but he doesn't make it either. So if I'm really being true to myself and, like, what I believe, three guys who I love and one guy who I actually don't love make my Hall of Fame. The guy I don't love to start is Stone Cold Steve Austin. Mm. I put him in my Hall of Fame because I do think it's undeniable.
He has
you
to
know
be.
How important he was, how big he became, the combo of the promos, the attitude, the work rate as a wrestler, despite not being a high flyer, you know, for much of his career when he was, you know, popular. But, you know, I held it against him early in his really epic run that he was playing this character that I've come to believe is much more like who he was than what I thought, because I was so hung up on his Hollywood Blondes persona that I really just didn't buy it. I was like, this guy coming in trying to be Mr. Badass.
Yep.
You know, I remember the Hollywood Blondes, and I preferred Pillman.
Yeah.
Nonetheless. So I put Stone Cold in there. Then the other three wrestlers I love. Number one, I'm just putting these chronologically, Bret the Hitman Hart. I love Bret Hart. I've always loved Bret Hart, and I will always love Bret Hart.
I'm going to bite my tongue.
The excellence of execution, you know. I put all my friends in sharpshooters, probably your brother at least once.
Yeah.
Much to his chagrin, I'm sure, and many of my other friends. And then Shawn Michaels. You know, I loved, look, and this goes all the way back. Like, I love the Rockers. I still remember the barber shop.
Yep.
I mean, if I didn't watch it live, I watched it within a week, you know, the Saturday morning recap, whatever it was. Yep. I mean, that was like such a moment in my childhood. And really the first time I started understanding sort of the dynamics between heels and faces and how all of that worked.
Yep.
And of course, he had those epic matches with Bret Hart. And the thing is, I was cheering for Bret. And that's when you know somebody's great, because he won me over.
Yep.
He won me over. You know, that Iron Man match is one of my favorite matches ever.
Yep.
Of course, the ladder matches with Razor. Like, you just can't beat it.
Yep.
You just can't beat it.
Yep.
So I would put Shawn next. So Stone Cold, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels. And then the subject of this conversation, for me, The Rock. I love him. I loved him as a wrestler. I loved him on the mic. I still remember his debut. I was watching that, you know, pay-per-view.
Survivor Series match.
Yeah, live, you know. And, of course, I remember being like, who's this corny dude? And then, you know, it all just worked because of the same sort of thing. You know, letting him take more control creatively over his character and letting him show everybody all the skills he had, which have translated to him becoming one of the biggest stars in the world.
All those guys – I'm pretty sure all those guys have the same thing in common, which was that they were phenomenal heels at
Absolutely.
One point.
If you can't work face and heel, look, in this, I honestly, the least wrestling I ever watched was during the Cena era. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have no opinions really on Cena other than I find him relatively charming in most of his acting roles.
Yeah.
But you know, I know the controversy over him never having a heel run, you know, has existed for a long time. And I think it's true. I think that's what keeps him from getting to that next level. Look at what's happened with Roman. Like, I'm in the bag for Roman. I don't watch as much as I used to by any stretch. I'm waiting for my son to get into wrestling. I can't wait. He's almost five, and I think it's coming soon. But, you know, I'm just like, I loved Roman before, and I think the heel run has been amazing. And it's been great, obviously, for WWE and the sport and him.
Yep.
And for it to culminate with a match with The Rock, like, what more can you ask for?
I know. So, mine, finishing up. HBK, the GOAT, favorite of all time, Flair, Stone Cold, and I got to put Taker on there for
longevity Taker.
And the number of high quality matches. I didn't love him personally, but I got to put him on there.
I respect the longevity. And look, you watch those early Taker matches. I mean, he was so athletic. You know, and they'd always talk about that. They'd still talk about that late in his career as though he still was.
Yeah.
When I think maybe, you know, I mean, Lord knows, you know me well. You know, AJ's had to hear me complain about many an injury, and I'm much younger than Taker. And, I wasn't able to play the sports that I love to play by the time I was like 26.
Yeah.
So more power to any of these guys who do it as long as he did it. You know, I think of Taker like I think of young Brock, too. Like, I'm not a big Brock Lesnar fan, and certainly knows the news in the past couple of days has not been kind to him. But I still remember the first time seeing him, being blown away. And then he used to do this, you know, somersault finisher off the top rope that he quit because he broke his neck doing it. But it was the most unbelievable thing. Yeah. To see a man that size, you know, going for that move. And Taker had some similar things early in his career, you know, getting up on the ropes.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for taking some time today to talk about trademarks, talk about this news that hit and how businesses can think about trademarking as a part of their brand and give a lot of really, really strong advice to people that are maybe early in this process that don't think they need to get there, but that they should. Give us some plugs. Where can we find you guys? Where can we find Trust Tree? How can we get in touch with you for our listeners that are interested?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, anybody who's listening that wants to get in touch with me directly, you're welcome to email me at kevin@trusttree.com. Otherwise, trusttree.com. Go check out our website. You know, just a brief description of what it is. We have an online portal where you can order a trademark application. And so, you know, it's very easy. It'll take you about 15 minutes to fill out the form. And then you're going to hear from me if you fill out one of those forms very soon after that. So you can certainly find us there. We're on all the socials. If you go and hit us up at usually either at Trust Tree Trademarks or at Trust Tree or at Trust Tree PC. But if you throw in Trust Tree, you're going to find us.
Awesome. Thank you again. I look forward to having you on plenty as we develop and as certain things come up with trademarks, branding, things like that. But I know for sure that I can say unequivocally that now Crow knows trademarks. Thanks a lot, man.
Absolutely.